This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe whitetail deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Hi, I'm John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. This is Maximize Your Hunt. Welcome back, everybody. Let's see what's been going on in my day. I've had a lot of stuff going on. I'm actually working, and I think I've said this before, I'm not in the product world, but I will be selling, I think, in the next several years, some new varieties of plants that I think are going to be beneficial, particularly for my clients and their designs and layouts. But I will potentially offer those large scale, particularly through this podcast. So that's at least my plan with that. Beyond that, a couple things I want to mention. And one of the topics that seems to come up more often than not is there's a lot of interest in folks that have this myopic, I want to say less complex perspective on things. And I'll bring up a specific topic, switchgrass for that matter. Now, depending on your landscape, you know, the various plants that you're going to use in these systems of design may be very particular towards your climatic and landscape conditions. But let's say you want to choose switchgrass as a means to create bedding. And I've been asked this like almost a dozen times in the past month, you know, I need to have this large stand of switchgrass. And what we've talked about and taught on this podcast is switchgrass alone, just that planting, it's an excellent resource. It's kind of, I'll call it like a technology to keep it in simple terms, but it's a resource for a particular purpose. And if you're just planting switchgrass, you lack complexity on the landscape. If you have a property that's an island property, and there's a lot of them on the landscapes, I can think of some folks that are consultants that have these, you know, 100 acre, 200 acre property that's in the middle of nowhere, there's no pressure around them. Using switchgrass as a mean for cover is excellent. But fundamentally, it does not provide everything an animal needs. Now, let's just think about predation for a quick example. Let's say an animal is trying to attack another animal, and switchgrass can be used as a limiting access point for that particular animal. It could do an excellent job minimizing really small animal intrusion. But let's take a bigger animal, even a human for that example, getting into that particular, we'll say, less complex design. Much easier access, much easier intrusion. In an area where there's highly pressured deer, what you're going to notice or recognize is that they're more vigilant. And they're vigilant when they have fawns, they're vigilant when there's a high predation rate. There could be social pressures that create vigilant. So they have the spatial awareness and they're very attuned with their environments. Having just one layer of switchgrass or layers amongst that where there's a woody component, something to create a physical barrier separation is a much better idea in design. Now, switchgrass lacks complexity, meaning it's not normally a food source for whitetail deer. So in that, if you had a grass that was a food source, for example, it could be more benefit or more functional for that particular animal. And so what I want to say is think about the pressure that you apply to your properties. Think about the value of that plant. What's its general purpose for in the landscape? But don't overuse it and abuse it. And that's what I want to kind of end with before we get into the topic, because I think there's a lot of folks that are out there that have a large podcast like mine that are saying 7 acres, I want more switchgrass. And I'm like, you lack complexity in your landscape and you're so myopic because you have food sources all around you. You're not making the best decisions possible. And this could be the size of the property standpoint. If you have an extremely large property, sure, you can put a large swath of 5 to 10 acres in switchgrass. There's nothing wrong with that. But I think most properties aren't that size and, you know, they lack complexity. And I just want you to be more mindful of that. So my rant's over. Just something I want to comment on because I'm asked this question quite a bit. And I think that's kind of the best perspective. Some of the designs and layouts, I'll probably explain more because I feel like we need to kind of unravel and dismember the thought around these large swaths of switchgrass, because it's not a beneficial, particularly in my area, because of snow load, ice, those different climatic issues, they're not always aligned well with the design feature. So I'm going to switch back over. Let's get to the topic. We got Matt Williams back. What's up, Matt? How you been, man? What's going on with you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me back, John.
Good. If everybody doesn't know Matt, Mushroom Matt, a good friend of mine, and it's been a bit since he's been on, and I wanted to catch up with him because him and I chat all the time, and I'm always learning from him. He's got great ideas. He's kind of a do more with less kind of guy. I think you're a simple but very kind of engaged type of individual where you want to make sure you make the best decisions in the best environment, and you recently bought a piece of property, and I think we want to talk a little bit about your journey on buying this piece of property and some of the things you kind of went through that I think listeners can really benefit from as they think about their properties, either buying properties or dealing with loggers or making decisions or tough neighbors, those type of things. So why don't you just, re-engage and talk to us a little bit about what you've had going on recently.
So the property that I purchased, let's see, it would be not this February that just passed, the February before we signed on and closed on it. It's 40 acres, a beautiful 40, and it's part of an 80 acres that was my friend's dad's hunting camp. Now, my friend and I were the only two out there anyway, so his dad agreed to sell it to us and got the friend and family discount, so to speak. So I got a good deal on it. It's an excellent area. It's, you know, great potential for many years down the road if I ever decide to sell it, you know. It's a good investment. That being said, we had been leasing our old farm for many, many years, and I had wanted to reopen the farm, and I'm actually in the process of reopening the farm. Some of this new property is going to be farmed for mushrooms, and it's only a couple, 3 acres or so that will be dedicated to that, and that's kind of right there around my entrance, so to speak. But it has been a process, and the biggest part of this process has been interviewing loggers and foresters and developing the plan for it, because spend a million hours planning, then your execution is very easy. And so I had walked this property a number of times, and I've observations at it a number of years here. And so I had a pretty good feel for what was going on with it and how the animals were using it and the entire neighborhood that surrounds it. There's a 2,000 acre natural area next door with about 500 acres of no hunting that kind of butts up to it, and that's definitely a plus, obviously, and puts us in a really great spot in the neighborhood. But also here in the UP, we have a lot of wolves, and our deer population has been drastically declining. Well, this particular area is on the edge of town. It's only about 3-4 miles away from my house as the crow flies, and 7 miles as the road winds. And it's surrounded by farms and towns and people, and it kind of puts up this buffer, so to speak, where there's not very much wolf intrusion at all in that area. And so I have a vestige, or one of the last pockets of good deer herd kind of there as well. And it's in a deer yard, meaning all the deer to our north that are remaining and it hopefully will someday, you know, rebuild their populations. They move down here in the winter to escape the heavy snow. So it's in a good spot on the map as far as the geography of it all goes. And like I said, the hardest part was finding the right logger and the right forester to work with. I interviewed a lot of them, and I'm only 3 miles away from a paper mill that makes magazine paper. And then Louisiana Pacific makes smart siding 15, 20 miles away. So we still have a pretty decent timber market here. And I knew that, you know, that was going to be the case. So I'm a little less gun shy on logging here than I would be maybe in a different area. And so walking the property and looking at it and, you know, talking to folks and, of course, you know, helping other people do their properties is giving me some great insight. And I ended up having pretty much had my mind made up, but I had Jim Ward come in. He and I traded consultations last year, and he basically reaffirmed exactly what I was feeling, that, you know, you've got some bad stuff working against you. You've got great topography, and you're in a good spot on the map, and you're going to have to get radical. And by bad stuff working against me, the ground cover is sedge grass. The herbaceous story is going to be mostly wild sarsaparilla and ferns, as well as American leatherwood. And then the overstory is maple and basswood. So there's really not much going on there for wildlife. Now, there are some pockets of conifers and cedar swamp and white oaks and red oaks, et cetera, but there's just not an enormous amount of them. I would speculate that there's not even one per acre, right? There's just little pockets and names of them. So identifying all of those and taping those off kind of became job one. And then getting rid of all the understory that was undesirable kind of became job two before the loggers came in. Now, with the loggers, I was really looking for someone to do it my way, someone to come in and make wall of brush around the outside with all the tops of the trees and things like that, but also subdivide the property or kind of quadrant it off. And I'm using that wall of brush as kind of my access, but also to keep the deer from watching me, because they literally will sit and watch the entrance to the property. I have one way in and one way out through an easement. And if they have me pegged before I even get in there, then the game's over before it started. So using that wall of brush to keep them out, but also to keep trespassers out, because there's public next door, you end up with some trespassers. And of course, there's folks who, you know, there's not a whole lot of deer left in the UP, great pockets of them anyway. And so these folks driving down the road, even though I have a quarter mile easement to get back to my place, they see the road out on, or the deer out on the ag fields next to the road, and they just, they'll find a spot. There is deer at my place, and there isn't a whole lot of deer nearby, so it doesn't take long before people start to get very trespassy and even poaching quickly. So that, I've had some issues with that kind of stuff, and I wanted to really go to the extra effort to make sure there was a physical barrier that no one could enter or access the property without going through these specific choke points that I have for the deer to enter and access the property. And I have a camera on each one of those spots. So it's physically impossible for a human or a white-tailed deer to enter or exit the property without being on camera.
Now, Matt, really quick on that. You had those spots pre-planned, and you probably had a strategy that I'm assuming pressure would put those deer in those locations through those transition areas, or you know, how did you kind of... Okay, why don't you explain that a little bit?
So a couple of these spots are right where a swamp transitions to hardwood. Deer love to bed in those spots anyway. So kind of the thinking there is, one, it's hard to get a ATV or some kind of machine through those spots because you're going to get bogged down pretty quick. And that, two, in particular, you know, if I'm a cruising buck, you know, I'm going to come right on that transition anyway. So it's kind of, I accentuated the trails that were already there naturally, so to speak, and kind of manipulated them a little bit. But that was my thinking in it, was that I want to give them, you know, the deer that are in the area, kind of an air of comfort with this to a degree, and, you know, help them transition into using the property immediately after logging faster, but also keep it safe.
Can you mentioned, Jim had mentioned to you that there was, you need to be extreme about this, and maybe it's somewhat to do with, I don't know, the species that are in those areas, but as well as, you know, kind of what's the surrounding landscape. Can you kind of, why don't you describe that a little bit?
So because this place had been so overpopulated with deer for so many years before the wolves really took hold, and it was in a deer yard, the deer pretty much selectively destroyed a lot of the browse and the herbaceous species that we would find desirable, right? So American leatherwood, wild sarsaparilla, sedge grass being the kind of dominant shrubbery, you know, greenery underfoot, none of that really has anything for white-tailed deer at all. And so as a result, you know, what it basically becomes is a deer desert on the forest floor in a lot of ways. And so my property's not quite as bad because it was logged over 10 years ago and it's kind of got some regeneration there, but not much. There's a lot of autumn olive and things too, of course. But the properties that surround me are just a total deer desert in a lot of ways with regards to that. And so when Jim and I were looking at it, his exact words is, I've only seen a couple properties, you know, like this, where you just need food. You need a lot of food, you know, and you're going to have to get radical, and which was exactly what I had perceived.
All right, let's explain some radical suggestions between Jim Ward and Mr. Matt here. The wall component of that for shaping the property, you know, that makes a lot of sense to me. If it's a remediation or restoration, you know, strategy, that's a time consuming scenario where potentially you could exclude all the deer from that location and regenerate, you know, a fair amount of the native browse just with the exclusion piece of it. Is that a strategy of yours? I mean, I'm assuming you still want to hunt.
It is to a degree. When you look on the ground, and I can, you know, post a picture of this, especially when the snow's on, there is a million tiny trees that are, you know, 8 inches, 10 inches tall that can't get up off the ground because deer have kept them browsed down so hard. And the sunshine obviously is a huge factor, not getting sunlight to the forest floor. So there should be a fairly big jump up with a lot of that stuff already. But if I'm seeing that pressure continue and I feel that it's too much pressure with the wall of brush and the way I'm setting this property up with these little pinch points that they can enter and access through, I can close that entire area off and let it regenerate for a year, 2 years if I wanted to, or go in there and plant things like hazelnuts, which are big in my list. And other things, and get them off the ground before the deer are allowed to go back in there.
So did you, this, it's like a faucet turning things on and off within your design. And again, I don't have your design in front of me, but within your design, did you have smaller areas sectioned off so you can have that balance of deer having access to areas and other areas not so much within the design, just to create that separation? It's something that I've been doing more with clients just to create that regeneration potential when you have this overpopulation or prior issues that you're trying to remedy.
Right. Well, Jim Brocker, Jim Ward, you know, they use a lot of the compartmentalization, you know, to reduce social pressure.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
So you stack more deer up on a smaller property. Right. And so you're basically dividing off the bedding areas and dividing off, you know, your transition zones and things like that. So basically what I've done is set it up so I can close up to half of the property and still have a functional plan, so to speak.
Yeah, that's really smart. I kind of like that idea, particularly because you've just, you know, you're trying to remedy an issue of the past, and you're probably in a ripe time to do that based on the fact that population. I mean, I love these properties where, you know, there's kind of a lower floor population. My own properties, like this exact example, low deer population, I can come in and build habitat like nobody's business. I just have to do it intelligently, and I have to do it kind of all at once. And, you know, in this example that you're trying to bring up, it's very similar in that sense. Your orchestration of this, and I don't, you know, I'm interested, your topography. You said there's some, terrain variation. Why don't you explain a little bit the benefit of that and how you looked at it in your design?
Well, there is a lot of terrain features here, and it's almost a perfect mirror. If you were looking at the topography, if you looked at divided the property in half any which way you want, if you looked at one half versus the other, they almost mirror each other, and it's amazing. I'm on the top of a ridge, so I have a triple saddle on one side and a double saddle on the other, and then I have a couple cruising shelves on each side, so it kind of does that terrace thing. Sure. As it heads down to the bottoms there. And there's a creek on both sides, or the origin of a creek in a swamp anyway. And so you get this amazing terrain that's going to hold deer anyway and promote travel through there, of course, especially in saddles. So I've got the way that the different ag fields are around me, and with that nature center there, I kind of have the travel corridor that the deer are all going to take to get from bedding to food anyway. And so that's also why I kind of set it up. That's how I was able to kind of set it up to be able to close off half the property, because I still have, you know, a high spot for bedding and a cruising shelf and, you know, plots and so on and so forth, but a transition zone or a travel corridor in each half, so to speak.
Well, Well, it sounds like a kind of a, it's got a lot of, I want to say features that, that a lot of people should look at. You know, a lot of this, you know, I've been working on flat terrain recently. A client last week was flat terrain. And then the client a couple of days before that was really hilly terrain. You know, very different prescriptions, like in a design, from a design standpoint. But when you have this balance of, you've got some low areas, high areas, and the variation in topography is not so severe or extreme, boy, that's just dynamite. I almost been telling folks lately, like I've had people ask me like, hey, you know, I'm looking at property out there. You know, what are the kind of the terrain features that you're looking at? And I'm like, if you can get all different slope and aspect, but the variation in height of that terrain is not greater than 45 or 50 feet in totality, you're really going to have, and again, there's a lot of variation in there with a lot of flat areas as well, because you don't want everything sloped. You're just kind of in this perfect scenario. So you want variation in terrain, but you also want different aspects, so you get different lighting conditions. And then to your point, variation of species, you know, assuming you don't have this major habitat loss from, you know, years and years ago of just, I'll just say mismanagement. Let's get into selecting a logger, because I think this is a big piece of it. And forester logger, you know, combination thereof, Matt wants it his way because, you know, he knows best, right? And part of this is, you know, through the learning process and actually doing this, you're probably realizing some things that you could have done better, but you're planned out. So I kind of want you to talk a little bit about your story through the logging process. You're in the process of logging right now. So let's talk about, like, you know, real life example. What was good? What was bad? And how did you get to the point of selecting somebody at least you were comfortable with?
Well, it was a long process. I interviewed a lot of folks and talked to a lot of different foresters, and had some loggers kind of push back on me and say, you know, well, if you want wildlife, we just need to put a big food plot up where you can watch them from up on this hill, so to speak. And they, you know, those are obviously not the people I'm looking for. So money's always part of the equation. Hands down, you've got to pay the taxes on the property. You know, if you have a payment, all that stuff, you have to pay it all. So obviously I'm looking to make every dollar I can from this. And with the pulpwood market here being somewhat strong still, and then there being lots of other sawmills, they make the NCAA, like college basketball floors and NBA floors and high school gym floors here as well, at a mill. And then there's also a fairly decent sized molding plant here that buys basswood and uses it for molding. And so there's pretty good buyers, but getting the right forester who's connected with those buyers and who's willing to, you know, separate out the loads to go to those different purchasers is kind of a pain in the butt. And the foresters are worth every penny, because that's what their job's supposed to be, to get you as much money. Because when you get as much money as the property can possibly yield, they do too. And then, in addition to that, I wanted to have a survey done, you know, or have the boundaries clearly marked in a legally defensible way, so to speak, with the forester too. And so I have one neighbor on one side that, they like to move flags, right? The property flags, right after my official survey got done before I bought the place, they came in within a week and moved my pool back, and they tried to. Yeah, they tried to steal 40 feet off of a 40 line. So, you know, square 40 there, you know, 40 feet is a lot. That's a lot of property.
Oh, my gosh. How did you figure that out? Like, what happened? Well,
there's rocks. There's a couple big giant rocks, and then there's some old barbed wire fences that are growing into trees. And I had walked the property boundary before using Onyx, but I don't really trust Onyx. There's a lot of people on the internet say, well, Onyx will get you close, but, you know, you should consider it 30 feet. Roughly. And so I had kind of marked it before, and I'd walked it with the previous landowner, and he showed me. And then after the surveyor came through and marked everything, then I knew exactly where they were. And sure enough, this person had moved them. And so that encroachment just wasn't going to stand, because they didn't try that crap on the previous landowner. And so I wanted to make sure that when the forester came in, that they flagged the boundary and, you know, cut right to the line, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And so, and I warned him that, you know, hey, this person may move it, and they have the GPS in their machine too, you know, when they're harvesting, so they can tell how close they are to the boundary and everything. But I knew that was going to be an issue. And, that was one of my, you know, my things that we had to watch out for. And then also I needed a forester who was respectful, because I have an easement through my neighbor's property to get to mine. And that road can get very muddy in the spring. We just had our thaw of the ground. They're not even all the ice is gone off of our lakes here yet. And so that muddy road has to be repaired or restored to the way it was beforehand. And if there's mud out on the main road coming off of there, you know, that has to be cleaned up and dealt with, or the road commission will get fussy about that, potentially, you know, slap my neighbor with a fine or something of those as well. So there's some nuances.
Yeah. Can you go back to the, I like the tea. I want the drama. So can you go back to that, the line dispute? Did you have an interaction with a neighbor? Did you?
Nope.
Okay.
No, I knew what they had done. I'm relatively certain that they have a son that sits on the line, for rifle season. Now up here, when you say deer season, people think you mean rifle season. You know, that's what deer season is. The most youpers is, you know, rifle season only.
Sure.
And so, with that, I just want to make absolutely sure that it wasn't an issue. And that's another part of, you know, using that wall of brush around the perimeter of the property is to say, look, you know, you're not allowed.
So you went from a flag to a slash pile that they can't probably get through on their best day.
Yeah. Right. Good luck moving a 6 foot tall, 6 foot wide pile of slash.
All right. So yeah, I think the listenership needed to hear your remedy to that. That sounds, yeah, pretty extreme. That sounds like a Jim Ward extreme. I've flooded people, and I've definitely done my fair share of working with clients to ensure that their property safety is of the utmost importance to the design. So I like this. All right, keep going down this road. I like the remediation with the roads, the consideration of the neighbor, all important things. The easement, that's paramount. I mean, that is your entrance in and out. That's number one. So you said the forester was connected to the markets. That was a big piece of it. I want you to kind of go down the opportunity, because economics is a big piece of this decision. How did you weigh the economic versus the gains, the habitat gains? And then you've got to think about proper, we'll just say treatments, selections, how you manage the understory. Why don't you get into some of the particularities with some of the strategy you have at this point?
So I tried to get out in front of all this long before they ever came in. I basically decided on a forester last year. I want to say in July or August, I made my decision and signed a contract with them and set it up so he would come in this spring to cut. And there's part of a reason why I chose the spring is, you know, in late winter, early spring, when you cut a tree, it's more likely to stump sprout. If people didn't know that, it is much more likely. And I want those stump sprouts, or those mineral stumps, so to speak, you know, to improve browse and then also give me some side cover and, you know, food and bedding. And then, of course, deep winter food as a big part of this. So, yeah, it's just been a long, long process to get to here. But I got out in front of it, and I tagged all my trees last year prior to hunting season, the trees that I wanted to keep. Now, there's some pretty good-sized white oaks and red oaks, and there's nice vein of them, especially on my north boundary coming out of that swamp up onto the hill there. And same thing on my south boundary, kind of right in the middle of the 40. There's a group of red oaks coming up, and they kind of terminate right there. So I went in, I tagged all those, and then I went in and I tagged a bunch of ironwoods. Now, I know a lot of people hate ironwoods. It's a terrible tree, but ironwoods provide a lot of value.
Oh, I love ironwood.
In regards to food.
I love ironwood, by the way.
And I have a hard, first of all, deer scrape and use ironwoods as licking branches here almost exclusively. Mm-hmm. I very rarely find a scrape under any other tree, even an oak branch, right? And then secondly, you can use an ironwood as a barometer. If the deer are browsing on your ironwoods, not the stump sprouts, they'll eat all the ironwoods, stump sprouts are the little trees. But if they're browsing on a mature ironwood, you know, with the low-hanging branch, then you know that you need more browse. It's a good barometer.
Yep.
And then in addition to that, there's almost always beds in a cluster of ironwoods. Doe bedding usually, but there is. Go ahead.
No, I'm just trying to let everyone, they have poo-pooed this tree specifically.
And it's wrong.
It is completely wrong. One of the best food sources, early food sources for grouse. One of the major reasons that I have rough grouse in my...
As good of a food source as aspen is the grouse.
Absolutely. This time, absolutely. 100,000,000%, you know, and pay attention to that. And if you have a good, let's just say form, and I'm letting them grow in open spaces. So ironically, I'm sorry to just jump on your parade here, but ironically, I'm thinning to promote Those species of trees. So do I. Yeah. That's funny you're saying that. Wow.
Okay. And so they don't hinge cut extremely well, but they do stump sprout very well. But you can use them as structure for bedding in cuts real easy. And they last forever. You can use ironwood as a fence post.
Yeah.
You can make, you know, hand tools out of it. I mean, there are a million things. And not to mention it burns at an incredibly hot. I mean, it's like black locust when you burn it.
Yeah.
It's one of the best firewoods you can use.
Yeah.
So it has a ton of use.
I like it. And you said for hinge cutting, we use it exclusively. One of the primary species for hinge cutting in our areas. It does very well. In fact, everyone thinks it's on dry ground. We're promoting it in and around wet ground as well. So don't think it won't grow in wet areas. It will right around those wet areas. And it thrives. It absolutely thrives. And like you said, go ahead.
Those flower pods, too, those are a critical source of food, both for deer and for grouse. And they, you know, all winter they sit there. And when spring, when the snow melts off of, they just consume them like ravenous wolves for whatever it's worth. Also earlier in the year when they form their flower pods, the deer eat the crap out of all of them, they can reach as well. So, you know, there's probably 100 more reasons. But I tagged all my ironwoods, especially the stuff that was 6 inches and smaller. Do not cut this. Your best not to smash it.
Yeah, you know everybody who listens to this podcast right now thinks we're nuts.
And you're nuts. Yeah.
I know. I'm nuts. I know. I'm nuts. You're nuts.
Take it to the woodshed and see if it holds water, you know, because I'm telling you, you know, this is what I've seen. Even Jim Ward pushed back on this with me and was like, why are you keeping the ironwoods? You know, I wouldn't, you know, I'm not saying he would say he wouldn't, but he was kind of scratching his butt going, nah, that didn't really, stand up to what everyone else said.
Yeah, we're better friends right now. This is we're on the same page. Keep going. I really like all this. Right. Okay.
So I tagged all my ironwood just for that reason, for bedding pockets. And then also, you know, like I said, there's some of them I kept because they're critical spots where I want scrapes. And I make scrape lines. They're gonna have a line of scrapes anyway on a travel trail, so you might as well pick out a tree for it. And it's gonna take quite a while for a tree can grow back up in that space to be a good scrape tree. So I wanted to make sure that I kept as many of those as I could, especially the ones that were already existing. So I tagged all those. I also tagged my wife loves white birch, so I don't let them cut any of those, but there's not many of them out there anyway. But white birches, or all birches in particular, is a critical source of nectar for pollinators in the spring before all the flowers bloom. So when you get the woodpeckers and the sapsuckers that drill their holes in it, if you've ever seen a piece of birch bark that looks like someone took it to a drill press and drilled holes all over it, right? Well, in the spring, after the maples are done running their sap, that's when the birch sap begins to run. And people make birch syrup. I don't know if you've ever had it.
They make it in Vermont, and it's rich in flavonoids, and that's the big reason they make it. But it's not as prominent. But Vermont, in the state of Vermont, not so much in New York. Right.
And so it has like a 60-1 water to sugar ratio versus like a 40-1 on a maple tree. But it still has a lot of syrup or sap in it that it has sugar. Well, in the early spring, when that's running, before all those flowers come on, your hummingbirds and butterflies and everything show up, there's nothing for them to eat except for that. So I put a price of importance on that. Now, also with birch and basswood and especially ironwood and oak in particular, those are they're kind of like a sanctuary for mycorrhizae, right? So we have all the I've got a lot of chanterelles on this property that have a very high value to me as a mushroom dude, right? Because unlike morels, where you have to go find them every year and hope they're in the same spot, and maybe they'll come back, maybe they won't. Chanterelles appear in the same place every year. So I wanted to keep those and bolster those and make sure that they were there for my family to enjoy for many years to come. And so ironwoods, in particular, are one of the dynamic hosts of those. And so that I put a large, prominent, you know, placement on that. Same thing with my birch tree. So, yeah, it just kind of was selecting the overstory there to stay. For maybe non-conventional reasons, when the mushrooms prosper on your property, everything else does too. It's a trickle-down effect.
It is a trickle-down effect. So this is interesting. So you're taking all the time to make the decisions, emphasize a prescription to your forester, yet you still had a forester. And was it because of the market conditions and his placement in the market that was critical for your
financial benefit? Yeah, that was part of it. Yeah. Um, his, his dad owns a sawmill with his dad's friend. Now, I've known these guys for many years, and they've given me sawdust basically for free for many years. Okay. And that had something to do with it, too, because that family relationship goes a long way with me. You know, I have a long history with them. I interviewed all these other guys. Everybody got a fair shot. But in the end, it was this fella that I liked the most and was willing to do what I wanted, the way I wanted it done, and willing to listen to me and ask me why, and then say, wow, that, you know, that makes all the sense in the world.
Right.
You know, thank you for teaching me that, you know, instead of, we all hate it whenever someone, you know, pretty much knows everything. So trying to talk to somebody and they just kind of let what you're saying roll off of them like water on their back, it's not very, engaging, you know? So I you have to have a lot of trust with someone to allow them to come in and just basically clear cut your land in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Let's get into some of this. So you're saying what you want to keep, and then let's talk a little bit about what you're getting rid of or what you're trying to kind of.
Maples and big basswoods got to go. They got to go. You know, I'll keep my small basswoods because they hinge well and they grow well, and there's a lot of browse value there, but all that hard maple just has to go. We're potentially looking at the Asian longhorn beetle coming through in the next few years, and that's probably going to devastate most of these trees anyway.
Yeah, I think there's some fungal diseases in our areas, too, that are impacting hard maple that I'm not sure too many folks
are. Yep. And so that's a product of people maple-fying or cutting over for maple because it's projected to have the most value,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
And so with that, you know, I didn't want to be stuck holding the bag with 40 acres of maple that's basically dying like the ash trees are. You know, all the ash trees here are afflicted. And I still have some ash trees that are, 20 inches DBH or better, you know, and they're on death's doorstep. Matter of fact, the big ice storm we had a few weeks ago brought the tops off of a bunch of them.
Green
ash. Weren't coming in. Yeah, white, black, green ash, all of them.
Okay.
Right? So, yeah. So that with the ash borer devastating it, you know, all I was going to be left with is a bunch of standing sticks. And I tagged a bunch of standing sticks that I wanted to keep because the woodpeckers have already been in them. And they're basically junk for the loggers. I want wildlife.
Yeah,
you know?
Snag trees. Yep, big time.
Right. But I don't want, you know, a property full of them by any means. And so that was a big part of it with the maple, the big basswood. They just had to go. They had these huge crowns, you know, from being, well, I mean, they're long, tall, skinny, you know, or not skinny, but thick, basically with a big cauliflower head on top because they'd been cut over for veneer. But I didn't want to, basically, I knew that if I kept many of those maples, I was just going to be a continual game of having to cut the canopy wider and wider every time.
Yep.
Right. Until I ended up with a bunch of 3 foot around maple trees. And I kept about an acre and some change of maple trees for my maple syruping bush and to grow mushrooms in the forest, quote unquote. You know, mushroom logs, like shiitake in particular. But that's just about all of it this day.
Okay. Yeah, I just love the dialogue. And this totally reminds me of like some of the PDC stuff that I've done with zones and layout. And you've got mushroom areas and then these travel corridors or connectivity amongst these different features. Again, this is, you're building an ecosystem of hopefully resilience because you're picking good quality, but the biodiversity piece of this is huge. Let's talk a little bit. Do you have any chipping on the property? What are some of the other features or things that they're doing to your benefit? Because you know you were talking about putting in food plots and or at least somebody had brought that up as hey,
you know, I'm a farmer. I've been a produce farmer. I mean, I grew up in ag country and so on and so forth. And so I'm going to do some produce farming out there. Like I said, you know, I'm doing some mushroom farming, but I'm also going to do some produce farming out there as well. And there's a wall of brush around the produce area to keep the deer out because I've been through this song and dance before. To be honest with you, I'm probably going to just open up the gate to it whenever it's time for deer season and let the deer glean it off as well. But there are some other areas. I love standing corn. You know, I know there's a lot of people that dote on it. I get it. But I love standing corn. And there's a lot of standing corn near me. And every year, whenever all that other corn's cut, the person with the last standing corn on the road kind of wins, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I like planting corn. I like messing with soil and corn plot and everything like that. And I like to use corn the way other people would use switchgrass to kind of create design in food plots. Now, my food plot is just to hold them there till dark, right? Because once they, you know, it gets dark, they can go out and hit all the ag all they want. But if they go out before that, then everybody drives up and down that road, sees them, and when they see those antlers, they get a little trespassy. So I don't want that to be the case. And so, my plots are diversified. I use alfalfa on some, especially in the travel corridors, alfalfa and white chicory, not purple chicory, not green chicory. I'm real picky about my chicory. And then clover as well, all the different clovers I can get because diversity is awesome. Yep. But I use those specifically in a logging road fashion, you know, right on the travel corridors. And then also the little trails that wind through the bedding pockets, you know, that's kind of my basic mix for, you know, and I just go right to my farm co-op and get those seeds straight from the bulk bin. I can buy them by the pound, mix it myself in different ratios, things of that nature. I can go in there and sit, except for the white chicory, which I get from Northwoods Seed. And so I do that. And then whenever I get into the larger plot, you know, corn. And then you know how I feel about turnips. I hate turnips. I think it's a damn shame that anybody's still putting, why are we putting turnips in, you know, this is 2025, guys. We know better. So I'm looking at kohlrabi. There's different kinds of kale. I like Jacinto, otherwise known as dinosaur, aka black kale, or Nero de Toscano kale. And some people are beginning to package that, which is a Savoy leaf kale. And if you don't know a Savoy leaf, think of the spinach, right? That leaf shape, it kind of has those pockets, but it's smooth and curly. That's called a Savoy. So I like Savoy leaf kales. I like beets. A lot of people are starting to call that Savoy leaf kale, long-standing brassica forage, and I think Grandpa Ray packaged it up or something like that, where it's like a 50 or 90 day. Well, you can plant that in the early spring, and by the time that the freeze up comes, it'll be 5 foot tall and look like this palm tree, you know, for whatever it's worth if the deer have been pounding on it. But it gets way better with frost too. It has a much improved flavor with frost, noticeably.
Yeah. Can you go back to the discussion around, you know, part of your design includes food plots, but you know, you were trying to work in, so there's the economic piece of it. It costs money to do some of these activities.
Oh, yeah.
How did you pull that into the equation? Plus, it sounds like, you know, there's more work to be done on the property. And I don't know if, you know, you're attempting all that work, you know, dealing with
I'm doing it.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah.
Why don't you talk a little bit about your food plot?
Yeah. There's several of them. I like little small pockets of food plots. And then, of course, I mix my mushroom plots in with that, you know, trying to catch water and increase soil fertility and build soil and things of that nature. So, and then of course, you know, fruit trees, lots and lots of fruit trees everywhere I can stick one. And then I've grown American chestnuts from seed as well, because American chestnuts produce a nice crop and they do so annually. And, I like that versus, you know, an oak, which may or may not produce in a given year, maybe a bumper crop, maybe very little, may be nothing. So there's that consistency of chestnuts as well. So basically, I guess it would be a food forest, if you're familiar with that term, John.
I think
agroforest.
Yeah, I think the food forest concept that was introduced on this podcast, I think I introduced it separately, and I kind of explained the layout to the listenership, but maybe you should define it in your own term.
So a food forest is exactly what it sounds like. Prior to European colonization, this continent was basically one giant food forest where there was forested areas. Now, whenever Europeans moved into an area and they wanted to displace the Native Americans, they had a little playbook they went by. First, they cut down everything that produced food that the Native Americans could eat, right? Because if you do that, then there's no food. Secondly, you know, they kind of in the tradition of Thanksgiving, wait till winter hit and then go in and burn the village and, you know, destroy all the food that was put up for the year. I'm not necessarily doing that part, but the first part is something that, you know, I'm specifically working on. So hazelnuts, nanny berries, cranberries, high bush cranberries. You name it, go right down the list. If it'll grow in my climate, I'm interested in it, especially if it can take some browse pressure or I can get it up over the deer's head.
Yeah.
Hazelnuts are probably my personal favorite, but chestnuts, so on. So you're creating layers of height, and you know, starting with your ground floor, and this kind of blends into permaculture and civil pasture, but starting on the ground floor, you know, whatever it may be, let's say we have a lot of winterberry here. That's kind of like the base layer. It's kind of like an evergreen waxy, you know, and then moving up with, you know, all the stuff that I'm planning for them, like clover chicory, alfalfa, et cetera, but also, you know, all the red ocean dogwoods and, like I said, nannyberry, cranberries, and, you know, kind of is your shrub level. And then when you get to the small tree level, you're looking at, you know, fruit, different fruit trees and stone fruits in particular. So apples, pears, plums, apricots, Iowa white peach, my personal favorite. I think that's a wildlife tree that everybody's sleeping on. And you do a little Google and you'll find out that it grows like an American plum, only it doesn't have any of the issues that American plums have. So it kind of creates those motts or those thickets, so to speak, where they, you know, and Iowa white peach is, in my opinion, you know, maybe the best tasting peach that you've ever had. And it's very, very cold hardy as well. A lot of times you can't grow peaches in a cold environment. So for whatever it's worth, if you want to, you know, create a new trend in the wildlife world, Iowa white peach, that's the one.
I like that.
And then the American chestnut tree, you're familiar with the American Chestnut Foundation and the New York chapter's work creating the Darling 54, the GMO modified chestnut tree. So it's resistant to blight. For years, people have tried crossing American chestnuts and Chinese chestnuts and then breeding back to get blight tolerance. What they figured out eventually is that's not going to work. Never going to work. You're never going to get an American chestnut with Chinese chestnut resistance. There's always going to be those Chinese chestnut characteristics. And I don't know, man, I'm just not a fan of China. So I'm planting my foundation, which is planting American chestnuts. Now, there's a lot of people who are like, oh, yeah, well, that's never going to work. Well, I would think that, too, if I didn't know better. There's a forgotten hatch, I guess, groves. There's a few groves here in Wisconsin, in northern Wisconsin, that have survived the test of time. They were
I didn't know that.
And so they're not 100% blight resistant, but they have blight resistance, and they've been hanging out. So people, the Wisconsin chapter of the Chestnut Foundation, have been dispersing these, so to speak, and planted other, you know, chestnut groves or that have done well. And so my seeds come from that. So they already have a cold hardiness. I'm only moving my seeds maybe 50 miles north of where they were grown. So it's not like I'm trying to bring a seed from Virginia all the way up here where it's never going to work. And so I have these cold hardy chestnuts that I'm working on. There are other things that you could plant, you know, it just depends on what your focus is, you know, and some of the, what I would call family use areas, I'm putting butternuts in. I love a butternut tree. It's absolutely delicious, and it makes an amazing syrup, probably the best syrup on the face of the planet. And so we're basically creating a food forest so that if everything went to crap tomorrow and we had to go there and survive, we at least have a shot at it, you know?
Yeah, I think the layering system, and I think this even kind of ties into what I was talking about in my intro, is thinking about these kind of complex ecosystems, but introducing plants that have, you know, ecological services in abundance, right? And so I think thinking it at the ground level and even below that, the fungal layer, you talked earlier about, you know, the mushroom aspect of that. I'd like to thank everybody for listening this week. There'll be a part two of this podcast. Matt and I get into more details on more information on mushrooms, bad forest management, creating better soils, some topics related to historical analysis done on different species of trees and forest management, and we explain a new way to manage and protect trees. Thanks for following and listening. See ya.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
You saw the game-winning play once, but have to replay it 3 times on the way back to the hotel. Because some moments don't end at the buzzer. life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
I saw this app.
I got a hit.
In the new limited series, DTF St. Louis, Jason Bateman, David Harbour, and Linda Cardellini star as three suburbanites who spice up their love lives.
Wow.
Don't miss the new HBO original limited series, DTF St. Louis, premiering March 1st on HBO Max.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable.